The following is a presentation of the American College of Osteopathic Internists.
Welcome to this recording of the American College of Osteopathic Internists Internal Medicine Board Review Course. The course was held in Baltimore at the Marriott Waterfront Hotel on May 8th through 12th, 2019. The course featured nationally known speakers covering a wide variety of topics of importance to the internist preparing for initial certification or for recertification in the specialty of internal medicine. Basic Oncology, Markers and Genes is presented by Dr. Kevin Hubbard.
Thank you, Sherry. We'll go ahead and dive into some of the basic oncologic aspects. And then after this, I'll be talking about clinical oncology. One of the things that you'll notice in any board review course is that you might on occasion find that somebody presents something that, gosh, you know, I just read that article in the New England Journal of Medicine last week, and they talked about A, B, and C, and that's kind of new, interesting information. I wonder if they're going to talk about it here. The answer is no, we're not. And the reason that we don't is not that we don't want to provide the most up-to-date information. It's because there will be a lag in the boards of anywhere from 2 to 3 years. So if it got reported and it's a really landmark thing and it's a game changer for all of us in practice, you won't have to worry about it on a board exam for a minimum of 2 to 3 years. So sometimes people come to these things and they go, oh gosh, man, I thought they were gonna talk about this. They didn't even say anything. The reason is that we're preparing you for board examinations, and so we're focused on what's on the boards for situations like this. So I just kind of wanted to provide a little bit of a disclaimer. Well, the challenge in basic oncology is that it's a little bit of a hodgepodge lecture. We're going to cover quite a few things, and so it's one of those things where you just kind of have to buckle in and strap in. You know, I sometimes, when I was doing this early on, I'd tell people covering this topic is like trying to paint the Taj Mahal with a gallon of paint. You can do it, but you got to spread it really thin. And so that's the idea here, is we're going to try to cover as much of some of the basic oncology aspects as we can for you. Now, this information will be primarily for initial certifiers, but for those of you who are recertifying, just so you know, there might be a couple of these questions that show up on the recertification board as well. Well, just so you know, I don't have any financial disclosures. I can't be bought, but I can be rented. Any monies that I would ever earn from speaking and things like that, 100% of that goes to feed hungry children. Mine. Let's talk a little bit about the biology of cancer. You've probably tried to forget about this because it really feels like you're sitting in first or second year back in school, doesn't it? Well, we're going to cover this. We're going to just kind of hit the main points, and so bear with me here for just a few minutes. So there are certain karyotypic abnormalities that we can see. Normally, cellular characteristics are expressed under very tight, very stringent control. But in malignancy, we see that normal control subverted by a wide variety of genes known as oncogenes that regulate cellular activities. There's also, in some cases, loss of function of tumor suppressor genes, things that we call anti-oncogenes. And they can be responsible for the development of certain tumors. The classic example here is going to be retinoblastoma. A number of etiologic factors can be considered here. Genetic factors, radiation, tobacco, occupational exposure, medications, viruses, oncogenes and anti-oncogenes, and we'll touch on those briefly, every one of them. But largely, a lot of it just kind of has to do with our own environment, our own living habits, and our own environmental conditions. And I don't know about you, but I see the sign behind them that says you must be 18 to play. I kind of think they probably didn't get carded when they walked through the door. I'm just kind of going out. But you kind of get an idea about those people that have kind of had those lifestyles where they've gone out and they've kind of lived hard and played hard, kind of live on the cutting edge of life. And those people are going to have increased risk for the development of malignancies. For many common malignancies, the incidence of cancer is higher among patients with a positive family history, and this strongly implicates genetic factors. as high as 25 to 30-fold for some malignancies. For example, breast cancer and bowel cancer. We will talk about those during this meeting and a little bit more specifically going forward. The inheritance patterns in general are going to be autosomal dominant with varying penetrance. So half of the children of patients with these disorders are going to inherit that genetic defect. There are four varieties of preneoplastic syndromes that you need to know about. These are those funny sounding names that we've all kind of heard of and probably tried to forget just a little bit because they're kind of hard to pronounce and hard to understand. The hamartomata symptoms or phacomatoses are the first variety. And this includes those funny sounding names like neurofibromatosis, von Hippel-Lindau, tuberous sclerosis, Cowden syndrome, Peutz-Jeghers syndrome, and multiple exostosis syndrome. These are most commonly benign lesions, but the genetic defects are of such a nature that they can undergo malignant transformation into sarcomas. These patients may also develop gliomas in the brain. They can develop them in the optic nerve. They can develop meningiomas, certainly intracranially, but extracranially as well. They can develop acoustic neuromas, and they can also develop pheochromocytomas. The second type are the preneoplastic syndromes or the genodermatoses. And when you're trying to remember these, try to have a little fun with the Greek that we all kind of brought with us. So geno, genetic, dermato, skin, osis or OCs, condition, genetic skin conditions. And you can get to this pretty quickly. This includes xeroderma pigmentosum, albinism, Werner syndrome, epidermodysplasia verrucoformis. You guessed your points in Scrabble if you can get that thing on the board. Dyskeratosis congenita, polydysplastic epidermal lysis bullosa, all those fun sounding names. Now note that I made the comment that most of these are going to be autosomal dominant. Well, this is a group of people that are autosomal recessive in their inheritance pattern. So this is one of those exceptions. So genodermatoses are autosomal recessive in their inheritance pattern. And then we've got hereditary immune deficiency syndromes, some other interesting sounding names, things like ataxia telangiectasia, Wiskott-Aldrich syndrome, late onset immune deficiency, and X-linked agammaglobulinemia that play into that as well. Now, these people are at risk for lymphoproliferative malignancies, and so be on the lookout for those. Think about possibly, in particularly in younger patients who have a history, if they give you a case, younger patients with a history of multiple infections and things like that, think about those hereditary immune deficiency syndromes. And lastly, chromosome breakage disorders. You know, anything that's labeled chromosome breakage can't be good, right? And that's what we see here. We see Bloom syndrome and Fanconi syndrome. Now, this is the congenital Fanconis and not the Fanconi syndrome that we sometimes will see in the kidney. Again, autosomal recessive. Well, you know, they're always, say most of them are autosomal dominant, but it's always good to know those exceptions. So here's two more for you. They're autosomal recessive, and they have chromosome instability and rearrangements of the karyotypes, these patients are going to have an increased risk of acute leukemia. And then there's our friend Li-Fraumeni syndrome, or SBLA syndrome. Now, many times these patients will have P53 mutations, autosomal dominant, and they will be predisposed to the development of multiple malignancies over the course of their lifespan. So they can get soft tissue sarcomas, breast cancer, brain tumors, leukemia, lung cancer, adrenal cortical carcinomas. And so that was where the term SBLA came from. Or if you're like me, you know, if it's just an acronym, we'll just kind of turn it into SLAB. I just don't know why SLAB is easier for me to remember than SBLA, but it got published as SBLA. So I'm trying to be consistent with the literature that's out there. Li-Fraumeni, particularly since Dr. Fraumeni is just up the road from me in Omaha, sort of feel like we have to pay him a little homage on that count as well. And another person from Omaha, Dr. Henry Lynch, described the Lynch syndrome. This is an autosomal dominant disorder that predisposes to non-polyposis colorectal carcinomas. That's Lynch 1. And then additionally, there's an association with patients who have colorectal carcinomas of the colon and the breast. We also see that those patients are at increased risk for cancers of the endometrium and ovary. That's Lynch 2. These patients have variations in DNA repair genes, and so things like MLH1, MSH2, MSH6, PMS2, or EpCAM, those patients are at risk for the development of this. And so what you'll see in a patient who might be given with this is that they have a family history of colorectal carcinomas, and then they might give you a woman who comes in and she has a mass in her breast and a strongly positive family history of colorectal carcinomas. Think about a Lynch syndrome in that particular setting. Radiation. Now, the good news is less than 3% of cancers result from exposure to radiation. In this graphic, you'll see a picture of, it looks kind of looks like a movie runner, known as the Conqueror. Now, I would imagine in a room full of Gen Xers and millennials, you may not be familiar with who John Wayne was, but there's a couple of generations ahead of you where John Wayne was like the big person, the big actor in Hollywood. It was who everybody looked up to. This is probably the worst movie John Wayne ever made. And he was in all those cowboy westerns and things like this. Well, in this movie, he plays Genghis Khan. I don't know who did the casting, but they ought to be shot. They filmed this in the Nevada desert, and they filmed it during the 1950s. Now, little history lesson. What were they doing in the Nevada desert in the 1950s? Nuclear detonations testing the atomic weapons program. Remember, it was just in its infancy, was in the years following World War II, and so the Nevada desert was loaded with radiation, and as a result of that, most of the cast and many of the members of the film crew wound up dying of various malignancies directly attributable to their exposure in the Nevada desert. So it's a great example of thinking of not just what you get from the sun, but the stuff that you inhale. And one of the things that we have to think about are radon daughters. Now, radon itself, when it degenerates, it just emits an alpha particle, goes just a few millimeters. Not a big deal if it hits your skin, but if you're inhaling it, now it contacts your respiratory epithelium. And as a result, you get DNA damage, and now you're at risk for lung cancer. So that's the general idea. Well, ground-level dwelling people are also at risk. I had meant to take a snapshot. My wife and I just moved to a beautiful new home, and there is a radon pipe that's in our house, and it's labeled and everything. So in many newer builds, you will find radon pipes. You may have one in your home if you've purchased one in the last few years. They're in our homes now, trying to mitigate some of the risk for developing radiation-induced malignancies. Now, nearly all tissues are susceptible to tumor induction by radiation. The bone marrow tends to be very sensitive to that. Also, the breast and thyroid are very sensitive to that. The latent period is only about 2 to 5 years for acute leukemia, but for solid tumors, it's going to be longer, generally a 5 to 10 year period of time. There's a higher incidence in those patients who've received radiation for neoplastic disease, which is what Sherry and I and our colleagues in radiation oncology have with our patient population. And prior to about 1950s, people got radiation for about everything. Radiation for ankylosing spondylitis because they thought it slowed the pathologic process. We see that children received radiation for thymic enlargement, and they subsequently developed thyroid cancer as a result of that. So think about potential exposure to radiation. Of course, the classic one is going to be skin cancer, and we know that that's the primary risk factor for that. And it occurs primarily on parts of the body that are exposed to sunlight. But trust me, you can get it where the sun don't shine. More likely, though, you're going to develop it on sun-exposed areas of the skin. Those patients who have genetic disorders, some of the things that we've talked about, such as those genodermatoses, are at an even higher risk for developing skin cancer. Carcinogenic effect is going to be in the range of 290 to 320 nanometers, that's ultraviolet, and that's where the damage tends to occur. So when you drive by and you see those tanning beds, make sure that you give them one of your business cards, because they're helping us out with that. That's the spectrum for UV-induced damage to DNA. The risk for melanoma certainly factors in, as well as it does for non-melanoma skin cancer, and the risk is cumulative over the course of time. In those patients who've had three or more blistering sunburns, the incidence of melanoma is six times greater than it is for those people who have not had three blistering sunburns. I've had two, and I promised myself I'm not going to get that third one. I don't care if I have to turn into a hermit. Lung cancer incidence 10 to 20 times higher in smokers than in non-smokers. Tobacco smoke causes everything. If they give you an association, cancer and smoking, the answer is yes. It probably is somehow related. Oral cavity, I think we all would get that. Esophagus, yeah, upper aerodigestive tract, not hard. But look at some of these others, kidney, bladder, and pancreas. So it can affect cancers in those areas as well. The problem is with tar, those polycyclic hydrocarbons that have been shown to be contact carcinogens. Oh gosh, Kev, how many of those are there? There's over 500 known carcinogens in cigarette smoke. You know, I mean, you just need one, right? Over 500 separate carcinogens. So we can see that these problems can cause malignancy. They can act on the internal organs. And it accounts, tobacco-related malignancies account for 1/3 of all male cancer deaths and for 10 to 20% of all female cancer deaths that are out there. So just in case you had any question, smoking and cancer, just for everybody on the side here, smoking, cancer. Just in case there was any question about the connection, I just kind of thought I'd show that to you. And as a result of increased use of tobacco by women in the period since World War II, unfortunately, the incidence of lung cancer deaths in females now far surpasses in women the deaths attributable to breast cancer, which is the most common occurring malignancy in women. But the good news is, if we can get our patients to stop, there's a gradual reduction in risk, so the likelihood that patients are going to get get a malignancy of the lungs is much less. So there's a role that we can play here. Okay, now everybody's got a slide in their slide deck that you just have to memorize. This is my slide in my slide deck that you just have to memorize. On the boards, they love questions that look at this. Occupational exposure and its likelihood of developing a malignancy. They love those things. And so take a look at this slide and try to commit it to memory between now and the time that you take the boards. Initial certifiers, you're probably looking at 3 to 5 questions right here. Recertifiers, maybe 1 or 2 questions right here. So hopefully this is that money slide that you just got to memorize, because it can help you in the points. So arsenic causes cancers of the lung, skin, and liver. Asbestos, we all know about mesothelioma, but remember, asbestos is also an independent risk factor for non-small cell lung cancer. Benzene, we all played around with it in organic chemistry in undergrad. Well, as it turns out, it causes leukemia. But the good news is, if you're sitting in this room, the period between your exposure and the development of leukemia probably makes it very unlikely that you're going to develop leukemia directly as a result of the benzene that you were exposed to in undergrad. So just to help you feel a little better about that. Benzidine, a derivative of benzene, can cause bladder cancer, chromium compounds, lung cancer, mustard gas. You know, I don't know too many of us that have been exposed to mustard gas, but they always ask these things on boards. And so here it is, mustard gas like they used in the wars back in the 20th century can cause lung cancer as well. Polycyclic hydrocarbons, lung and skin cancer, and here's the classic one. This one is just, this is the big money question, vinyl chloride, angiosarcoma of the liver. Vinyl chloride, angiosarcoma. I don't know what it is about vinyl chloride and angiosarcoma that they love so much on the boards, but there it is. right in front of you so that you can get that one. Well, what about air pollution? Is there a risk factor for that? Well, as it turns out, there actually is. Lung cancer incidence, we know, is increased by smoking and by certain occupational and industrial exposures. Again, primarily relatable to coal tar and combustion byproducts. There is a higher incidence of lung cancer, as it turns out, in urban dwellers above and beyond industrial and occupational exposure. Now, it's not a huge increase, but it does appear that the likelihood of developing malignancy if you live in an urban setting is a little bit higher than it is if you live in a rural setting. Okay, we'll tie in next to medications. I keep thinking every year that maybe this will be the last year I have to talk about DES, and every year I explore it, it's still in the literature. People still kind of bring it up from time to time, so I'm keeping it in there for this year. But when women back in the 1950s and early 60s were taking diethylstilbestrol, we discovered that in their daughters who were exposed in utero, there is an increased risk of vaginal and cervical cancer in those daughters. And so you hear about DES daughters and things like that. So there's that component just for historical purposes, but just in case it shows up. We do know that estrogens increase the incidence of endometrial cancer, and the risk is decreased by the use of additional progesterone and a decreased estrogen dose as well. There is a correlation between estrogen exposure and breast cancer development as well. So in those women who have to take an estrogen replacement therapy, you want to try to keep the dose as low as you can. And if a woman has a uterus, then we should also consider progestational agents as well to try to mitigate some of that risk. Well, unfortunately, you're looking at one of the causes of cancer. It's me. It's people like myself who administer chemotherapeutic agents to fight malignancies. The biggest culprit in this group are going to be the alkylators. Alkylating agents cause increased incidence of acute myelocytic leukemia, bladder cancer, and probably other malignancies as well. BRAF kinase inhibitors, things like dabrafenib and those sorts of agents, they can cause keratoacanthomas and squamous cell carcinomas of the skin. Now, what's really interesting about that is that we kind of learn in school that if it hurts when you do something, don't do it. But in this situation, as it turns out, if patients develop these and they're getting good responses in their malignancy that you're treating them for, these are kind of considered incidental malignancies that creep up. And so what we do is we manage those keratoacanthomas and those squamous carcinomas of the skin with local therapy, and we keep rolling with their systemic treatment. So something to consider in that situation. Androgens increase the risk of prostate cancer. Immunosuppressive agents. Think about organ transplant patients treated with immunosuppressives, things like azathioprine and prednisone. There's an increased incidence of large cell lymphomas as well as a variety of solid tumors. There's another question that oftentimes will show up on the boards, and that is that you've got a patient who is status post a renal allograft maybe 3, 5, 6 years ago, and they've been on immunosuppressive therapy ever since then. And that patient gets admitted with altered mental status, CT or MRI done in the emergency department shows a big midbrain lesion and a lot of swelling. What's the diagnosis? The answer is primary central nervous system lymphoma as a result of their immunosuppressive therapy for their renal allograft. So that's a really classic one that they like to put on there. So just so you all are aware of that. We do have some medications, fortunately, that we can use as cancer preventatives, and this would include things like calcium and nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, aspirin. Now, they're not marketed for this, and we don't often think of them as that, but we've actually seen the patients who take these medications on a long-term basis have a lower risk for developing colorectal carcinomas, interestingly enough. In fact, celecoxib, a COX-2 inhibitor, marketed under the trade name of Celebrex, has been FDA approved for treatment of familial adenomatous polyposis in those patients who can't or won't be able to undergo a colectomy. So it's certainly effective in that particular setting. What about vitamin D supplementation? You know, we've got some data out there that shows that with vitamin D supplementation, it may lower the risk of recurrence of some solid tumors. It may lower the incidence of certain cancers from developing. And the ones that we typically think about are breast and colorectal carcinomas. So the data is still kind of soft there. I think they'll kind of stay away from this on the boards. But just in case they decide to give you a question on that, that's what our current thinking is. But it's pretty soft at this point. Needs a little bit more firming up, I think, before we can recommend it for standard practice. We have some other drugs that we utilize. Tamoxifen, marketed under the trade name Nalvadex, is a selective estrogen receptor modifier, or SERM. It's effective in decreasing risk of breast cancer in women who are at high risk. Raloxifene, or Evista, has been marketed in decreasing second primary breast cancer, but as it turns out, it doesn't lower the risk of in situ carcinomas of the breast. And so we still tend to favor tamoxifen over raloxifene in this particular situation. What about diet? Boy, easy to poke fun at that now that we're all away from home and enjoying some of this wonderful food that we've got to enjoy in Baltimore. Well, as it turns out, that evidence strongly correlates the intake of fat with cancer at several sites, especially the breast and the colon. We don't know, but we've been postulating this for many, many years now. And I can honestly say, as someone who's followed this literature for 30 plus years, I don't know that it's really gone anywhere and that we've really learned nearly as much as we need to know about this. But the things that we have been able to correlate are, if you have increased adipose tissue, you may have higher estrogen levels. That could increase your risk for developing breast and endometrial carcinomas. Or we could increase bile salt excretion. That could alter gut flora. We're learning more about the microbiome in the gut all the time. Maybe that increases the risk of production of some carcinogenic substances. Maybe it affects GI transit time. All sorts of these things that we've kind of kicked around. Well, here's what I think you probably will need to take with you to the board examination, and that is we have linked patients who eat high-fat diets with cancers of the breast and colon. A high total caloric intake will hit breast, endometrium, prostate, colon, and gallbladder. Those patients who consume a lot of red meats, animal protein, and things like that, breast, endometrium, and colon. People who consume alcohol, and particularly in smokers, think about upper aerodigestive tract, mouth, pharynx, larynx, esophagus, and then in addition to those, the liver. Remember that alcohol and tobacco are synergistic for cancers of the upper aerodigestive tract. Salt cured, smoked, or charred foods. You know, I'm from Kansas City, where it's barbecue and steak on every street corner, and this really hits close to home. So esophagus and stomach wounds up in there, and yeah, I reflux a little bit too. You wanna make something out of it? I like my barbecue. Come on, leave me alone. But it's what we have to contend with, and so something to consider as you're looking at those things. Nitrate and nitrite additives, intestinal carcinomas are going to be the concern there. There is no support for the anti-carcinogenic value of particular vitamins, minerals, or nutritional supplements in those amounts greater than provided by a good, prudent diet. We've kind of looked at vitamin A congeners and their ability to maybe lower the risk or to act as differentiating agents and things like that. So we're kind of seeing some role for vitamin therapies that are out there, but really hasn't taken hold as we thought it might. Infectious agents are another potential cause for cancer as well. Here, the human T-cell lymphotropic virus, HTLV-1, the kissing cousin of the HIV virus, is a retrovirus that's associated with T-cell lymphoma, cutaneous T-cell lymphoma, also known as mycosis fungoides, and acute T-cell leukemia. Epstein-Barr virus is closely associated with African Burkitt's lymphoma and with nasopharyngeal carcinomas as well. Hepatitis B virus has been strongly linked with the incidence of hepatocellular carcinoma. There are some cofactors that go into that, and that's going to be malaria, malnutrition, or those patients who have been exposed to aflatoxin. No stranger to malignancy, hepatitis C virus accounts for about one-third of all cases of hepatocellular carcinoma in the United States each and every year. And it occurs almost exclusively in those patients who have cirrhosis. Herpes simplex virus has statistically correlated incidence with cervical carcinoma. It can also have been a cofactor for some of the upper aerodigestive tract cancers, such as carcinomas of the lip and mouth. Human papillomavirus has a strong correlation between cancers of the labia, vagina, cervix, penis, head and neck, and anus, because it tends to be a sexually transmitted infection. There are two vaccines on the market, hope to decrease the incidence of these types of cancers in these patients' populations as well. It's coming. We'll kind of see how it goes. It's probably one of those things where we'll need about a good 10 to 20 years of good epidemiological data to really know how effective it's been. Helicobacter pylori, we know about its risk factors for peptic ulcer disease. As it turns out, it also is an independent risk factor for both gastric carcinoma and low-grade lymphomas. Antibiotic treatment in the face of the lymphoma has caused regression of the lymphoma itself, and so it can be effective. So think about your Helicobacter pylori infection treatment regimens, and remember that they can also be considered in a situation like that. We'll kind of wrap this up with oncogenes and anti-oncogenes, just kind of to get a couple of definitions out of the way here. A proto-oncogene is a presumably normal gene that may be a target for carcinogenic agents. Remember, it's not causative of cancer in itself. Once it becomes activated, an activated proto-oncogene now is an oncogene, a cancer-causing gene. An anti-oncogene is a gene which prevents formation of a given cancer. It's also thought of as a tumor suppressor gene. So there are some things out there that you just kind of need to be able to correlate. So think about HER2 overexpression for breast, certainly, but as it turns out, for ovarian and gastric carcinomas. RAF, gastric, thyroid, kidney, and melanoma. And then we have two families to talk about, the RAS and the MYC families. So the RAS can be associated with cancers of the bladder, the lung, and colon, and with leukemia. The MYC families with lymphomas and various carcinomas, neuroblastoma, and L-MYC has been associated with small cell lung cancer. BCL2 has been associated with lymphomas. We are all the time getting better genetic sequencing assays as well, and we're beginning to look at risk of recurrence in terms of trying to come up with some effective strategies. And so Oncotype has now been marketed for breast and for colorectal. They're currently looking at genetic sequencing for a number of other malignancies. There's just no data out there. And so risk of recurrence is the information that we are looking for, and that helps guide our thinking process as to what types of therapies might be indicated, and whether some patients could be monitored by just watchful waiting. We do know that with respect to those oncogenes, we'll have specific therapies that are available. So for BRAF, for melanoma, we have things like vemurafenib and dabrafenib. For MEC, again for melanoma, trametinib, ALK. It's a marker for agents like crizotinib and ceritinib used in non-small cell lung cancer. And for BCR-ABL, of course, that's chronic myelocytic leukemia. And we've got an entire group of tyrosine kinase inhibitors with imatinib, dasatinib, and nilotinib that are available as well.